Hi, everybody. This is Danny Fisher, and you're listening to the Buddhist Studies Podcast. Okay, everybody, we are going to hit the ground running today because we have a lot to go over. First of all, I wanted to go over a bit of the feedback that came in about the podcast at this point. One listener wrote that he was hoping for somewhat shorter podcasts. I've been shooting for shorter, but we've run long the last two. The first one was about an hour, and the second one about 50 minutes. I'd like to keep these as short as possible, but I also want to bring a certain level of attention and detail to these podcasts. So I'll do the very best I can and perhaps try to cover less material in the future in such a way that makes sense. So I'll do my best on that. The second note is from our friend Chuck Priebisch, whose work we've been using. And Chuck chimed in that we believe I'm pronouncing Jan Natier's name correctly, but I mispronounced Stephen V. Beyer's name. I called him Beyer, and it's Beyer is how you say his last name. And I'm mortified to discover that I've been mispronouncing Chuck's last name, which is actually Priebisch, not Prebisch, as I was saying. So apologies all around, and again, no intentional mispronunciation on my part. One of my dear friends with whom I have a teasing relationship always tells me that no matter how much Buddhist work I do, I'll always be an Indiana Rube at heart, and I certainly feel that way when I'm not able to pronounce names correctly. But I will do my very best in the future. So today we're going to go over section 1.3 in Buddhist Religions by Richard H. Robinson, Willard L. Johnson, and Thanissaro Bhikkhu. And as I alluded to last week, this is very much the story of the Buddha's life. The title of this section is The Quest for Awakening. Now, the authors make the point that basically the earliest material we have on the life of the Buddha comes from bits and pieces scattered throughout the Pali Canon. And also in the suttas, the discourses, and also in the Vinaya, which is the sort of monastic code of conduct. And it wasn't until more than 400 years after the Buddha's death before entire formal written biographies start to appear. So again, the earliest material that we have isn't really collected into one story. It's sort of bits and pieces that are alluded to. In John S. Strong's The Experience of Buddhism, which is one of the texts that I'm using as a sort of supportive resource, he gives an example of this from the text where Ananda talks about the birth of the Buddha. And that is, let me give you the number on that if you have that one at home. It is story 1.3 in The Experience of Buddhism, and it's just a clipping from the Pali Canon in which Ananda tells some of the disciples and people hearing his recounting of the Buddha's teaching about an aspect of the Buddha's birth. Now, some of these biographies that appeared long after the Buddha's death are, you know, quite famous and well-known in their own right. Chuck, in his piece for Buddhism, A Modern Perspective, which is about the life story of the Buddha, and I'll have the information on that in the bibliography, he lists sort of four of the major biographies that we have later. And again, much of the story that I think we popularly know is influenced by more, but perhaps by these biographies than what's in the Pali Canon. And I said four, but I meant five. We're going to talk about one more, but I just want to say a bit about the other four. So one is the Mahavastu, which is translated The Great Account. And as Chuck says, it's sort of attributable to the Lokottaravadin subset of the Mahasamgika school, and it's written in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. So that's one I think people are generally familiar with. There's also the Lalita Vistara, which is translated as the detailed account of the sports of the Buddha. And it's attributable to the Sarvastivadins. And the Mahasamgikas and Sarvastivadins we'll hear more about later. There's the Nidanakata, which is the connected story, as that's how it's translated. And it's written by Buddhaghosa, who's another figure we're going to hear more about later, an important explicator of the Theravada tradition. And as Chuck puts it in his piece, this is effectively kind of an introduction to the Jataka tales, which are sort of the early stories of the Buddha's previous lives, and we'll hear more about those later as well. And then there's also the Abhinishkramana Sutra, which is translated Discourse of the Great Renunciation. It's lost in the original. We only have it in translation. And that will be a theme with some of the texts that we look at. We'll talk a little bit later about the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra. And as I understand it, there's a team of Japanese scholars who have located this text in the original, but what we've had up to now are Chinese and Tibetan translations of the Sanskrit. So there's a famous text where, again, we don't have the, up until now anyway, we've not had the original. We've only had to deal with translations of it. So it's a bit, the problem with that, of course, is that it's a bit like playing telephone, that you're kind of losing something when it's translated twice. And the fifth that Chuck mentions is the sort of very, very well-known epic poem by Ashvaghosha, which is called the Bodhicharita. And we're going to hear a bit more about that from Robinson Johnson and Thanissaro Bhikkhu here. You know, one of the things that they say, of course, is that given some of the problems we have about locating the Buddha precisely in history, they say the quest for the historical Gautama is predestined to a measure of failure. And, you know, again, the problem with what's real and what isn't is compounded by these biographies, which often have conflicting accounts or have things arranged differently in the story. I'll talk about a couple of those changes as we go through the story. But they also write this, which I think is very helpful. Although the historical truth of the accounts may never be proven, the accounts themselves are undoubtedly of historical importance, as they've inspired Buddhists by the millions over the past 2.5 millennia. So again, maybe they don't represent a perfect historical record, but they seem to capture something of this person at the center of the Buddhist religions. And also in and of themselves are quite valuable. I imagine many of you, like me, have been touched by the story of the Buddha, and that in itself means something, is important in what it's inspired and challenged us to do in terms of our practice. By the way, I alluded to these differences across biographies, and John S. Strong gives that a little bit of attention in The Experience of Buddhism. So if you also have that book and you're playing along at home, on page 9 he says a little something about that that's useful, I think. Now, the authors, Robinson, Johnson, and Thanissaro Bhikkhu, base the story that they tell, the version of the Buddha's life that they tell us, on two sources. One is these fragments of a biography that we have in the Pali Canon, and the second is the Bodhicharita, the quote-unquote Acts of the Buddha, which is by Ashvaghosha. And Ashvaghosha would have written this in the first century of the Common Era, so, you know, 500-600 years, maybe longer, after the death of the Buddha, so quite a while after. And I think it's probably fair to say that it's the biography that's had the longest legs. If you go into a lot of bookstores and ask for a book about the story of the Buddha's life, or you have a story of the Buddha's life appearing in great collections of literature, usually that's what you're getting, is Ashvaghosha's biography of the Buddha, the Buddhacharita. And, you know, it's important to mention, you know, that these different stories are incredibly valuable, and these different approaches to telling the story. And I certainly can't be comprehensive in talking about them, but there have certainly, in just my lifetime, been some really, really wonderful, different, rich retellings of the Buddha's life. Most recently, last year, PBS did a two-hour film called The Buddha, and it was directed by a filmmaker named David Gruben. Featured interviews with people like, you know, Jane Hirschfield, the poet, who also worked with Thich Nhat Hanh in the composition of his work. The Dalai Lama is interviewed. Robert Thurman is interviewed. But they also retell the story of the Buddha's life through film in pilgrimage sites in India, animation. The animation is actually really kind of neat. I liked that approach. You know, I think there are some scholarly problems with the way some of it was done. There was a lot of dialogue about this on H Buddhism, the Buddhist Scholars Information Network online. You know, I think at the time, maybe I was sort of frustrated by some of that too, but I looked at it again recently in preparation for this podcast, and I found that I was more drawn to the things that about it that were good. So, you know, it's definitely worth a look. Thich Nhat Hanh has, frankly, if you ask me, I think it's really his masterpiece of all the books he's written. Wrote a biography of the Buddha called Old Path, White Clouds, which is mammoth, and is sort of the product of his drawing from the Chinese agamas, which we'll hear more about later, the Pali canon, and also his creative approach. You know, my last interview on the Buddhist Geeks podcast, Vince Horn, the host, and I talked a lot about both Ashvaghosha's Buddhacharita and Thich Nhat Hanh's Old Path, White Clouds, and so I think I'll spare going over some of what I think is great about that Thich Nhat Hanh book and just refer you to that, and I'll have the information about the podcast in the bibliography. Sherab Chodzin Cohen has a wonderful book with Shambhala Publications called The Awakened One, which is a sort of very intricately detailed but also kind of beautifully drawn biography of the Buddha that's you know, probably novel length, I would say, and again, based on a lot of research you know, I think particularly the Sanskrit sources. So that's well worth reading. It was the first biography of the Buddha I ever read when I went on the Antioch Education Abroad Buddhist Studies in India program. That was our prerequisite. We were asked to read Cohen's book. John S. Strong, who wrote or who put together The Experience of Buddhism, the book I keep referencing, wrote a sort of a scholar's biography called Buddha, A Short Biography, which I also read in the context of school when I took a class with Reginald A. Ray at Naropa University. And it's a valuable book as well. And I like that approach that he just sort of owns the this is the sort of more scholarly historical approach, but it's also very readable. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily written for budding scholars of Buddhism so much as it's written for anyone who's interested in that approach. Again, you'll have to forgive my pronunciation of all things East Asian. There was a manga series, I think it's how you pronounce it, these sort of Japanese comic books of the Buddha's life that I guess it was about 4 or 5 years ago started appearing. And very funny, a lot of irreverence, and I think that needs to be there. It's good for really bringing the story alive and having it pop. I believe they're adapting it into an anime, or have adapted it into an anime film that will soon be released here in the United States. And then, of course, there's Bernardo Bertolucci's film Little Buddha, which I think has a mixed critical reaction out there. It's certainly, not a classic, I would say, but oddly, I think the strongest material in the movie is the retelling of the Buddha's life, actually, in which the Buddha is played by Keanu Reeves. Yes, that Keanu Reeves. And I actually think he's quite good. I don't want to overstate too much on that, but I think he plays it very well. Visually, it's very interesting, some of the things that they do in that film. And I think the modern day story that's happening parallel to it in the film is not as interesting, but it's a very lush, pretty retelling of the Buddha's life, and I think worth seeing for that alone. So I mean, there's just a small handful of some of the really interesting biographies of the Buddha that have appeared just since I've been alive, so I think it's kind of neat. It's exciting that this story still inspires so much creativity and variety of approach to the material. That's, I think, the mark of a great story, and again, helps perhaps make Robinson Johnson and Tarnasore Bhikkhu's point that, however historically accurate it is, this is a really important story. Okay, so that said, let's talk a little bit about the history. There, as many of you probably know, there's no exact dates of the Buddha's life. We can only get within, 150, 200 years of his life. But, we can't be for certain beyond that point. Although, there's some interesting data, research, archaeology, so forth coming in, that I think has caused some people, scholars anyway, to maybe shift some of their ideas about a date. So this is from Donald Mitchell's book, which I've been using as well. And he writes, quote, "Today, many scholars place the span of the Buddha's life fully in the 5th century BCE. Damien Keown in his Oxford Dictionary of Buddhism kind of affirms this and says, perhaps the best historical guess is 485 to 405 before the Common Era. So again, completely within the 5th century BCE. Depending on whose dates you're using, what certain specific traditions say, it may bleed into the 5th and 6th century or even earlier from the 4th to the 5th. So it's varied, I think, the approach to the date. But this date, the fully within the 5th century BCE, I think reflects what a lot of scholars feel is the best information. Okay, so the authors start by saying that the Buddha's ancestors, the Shakyas, were, quote, members of a noble Kshatriya warrior class living in the northeastern Ganges River plain just below the Himalayan foothills. Now, we talked about the caste system last time, and this is sort of complicated. The Brahmins would be technically at the top of it, but perhaps functionally in society at the time, you could argue that the Kshatriyas were really the top, kind of top dogs in some ways, that... yes, the Brahmins would technically be higher, but in terms of what influence on society looked like, it might have been the Kshatriyas in this way. Shakya, the word translates as one who possesses power. So that's sort of the meaning of the name, and that comes from Mitchell. I'm going to translate a lot of these names here, and all of that comes from Mitchell. It doesn't appear in the Robinson Johnson Tarnasore Bhikkhu book. There are still Shakyas around today. One of my dear best friends and colleagues at University of the West, Miroj Shakya, who is our professor of Sanskrit and Pali, is descended from this clan, and it's obviously captured in his name. And he's from exactly the area in Nepal where the Buddha would have been from. So. It's a really interesting thing that you still have kind of a long line into the present day of this clan. This specific clan of Shakyas, the clan name was Gautama, which meant descendants of the sage Gotama. And Gautama is translated most excellent cow, and that's again from Mitchell. And, we spoke last week about the importance of horned animals of cows in Indian society, and that had a lot to do with recognizing the divine. So it's quite an honorific name. It may sound unusual so far removed from that context today, but there's a lot of meaning and honor in that name. The Buddha's father was named Suddhodana, and his name translates pure as pure rice. And he would have been the, as the authors say, the leading aristocrat in the town of Kapilavastu. And archaeologists have put this between the border of India and Nepal in the present day, the area here. And the authors say this as well, which I'll just read in full. During the later period when monarchies had become the norm in India, Buddhist chroniclers, including Ashvaghosha, portrayed Suddhodana as a king, but the earlier texts present him as simply one of a council of rulers of the Shakyan Agrarian Republic. His republic, like many republics at the time, was eventually annexed by the nearby kingdom of Kosala toward the end of the Buddha's life. So that kind of gives you more of a sense of perhaps who Suddhodana, the Buddha's father, really was. The Buddha is born, and his name is Siddhartha, which means one who has achieved his goal. He's also, I think, often known culturally as Shakyamuni Buddha, and Shakyamuni simply means the sage of the Shakyas. But right now, we're not to the point where he's going to be known as Shakyamuni Buddha yet. He's Siddhartha Gautama. So his mother Maya had a dream that a white elephant entered her body through the side. And again, there's a lot of auspiciousness and good omen, in the in Indian culture here. She was traveling at the time and was overcome, wanted to stop, and gave birth to the baby standing in a place called Lumbini, a garden near Kapilavastu, and it's in present-day Nepal. And according to the story, the baby is born, immediately stood up, strode 7 paces, and, quote, declared that this was his last birth. He was destined for awakening. And not long after this happens, the baby is presented to, I guess you might call him like a courtly sage named Asita, and he prophesizes that the baby will become the Buddha. And as the authors say, other accounts sort of explain this differently and say, for example, that he says the baby will either be a great king or a Buddha. And that gives the story that we're about to hear some more dramatic heft, if that's what was said. So, anyway. Not long after the baby's born, according to this, about a week, Maya dies. Suddhodana shortly thereafter marries Mahaprajapati, who is Maya's sister. So the Buddha's aunt becomes his stepmother. And she's responsible for raising the boy. Now, in terms of the Buddha's upbringing, whether we think of Suddhodana as a king or a leader in this agrarian republic, he would have had a quite a pampered life existence. It would have been an extremely sensual, and the authors use the word luxurious life. And in the Pali Canon, the Buddha himself talks about it a little bit, and I want to read that passage from the Pali Canon, which is section 1.4 of John S. Strong's The Experience of Buddhism, for those of you who are listening. So here's how the Buddha describes his life growing up. He says, "O monks, I was a spoiled, a very spoiled, and utterly spoiled, delicate youth. Just for me, 3 lotus ponds were made in my father's house, in which blue, white, and red lotuses bloomed. I didn't use any sandalwood powder that did not come from Benares, and my turban, my jacket, my under and upper garments were all of Benares silk. By day and by night, a white parasol was held over me so that I would be sheltered from the cold and the heat, from dust, chaff, and dew. And I had 3 palaces, O monks, one for the cold season, one for the hot season, and one for the rainy season. During the 4 months of the rainy season, I never left the palace and was attended exclusively by female musicians. Moreover, monks, while in the homes of others, unhusked rice was served along with sour gruel to slaves and servants in my father's house. They received good quality rice, meat, and gruel. And I'll stop there because there are spoilers. And I want to keep going with the story. Again, here he points that, you know, effectively 3 homes for the year, only the finest clothing, supplies, etc. Depending on which story you're hearing, Suddhodana is presented as somewhat desperate to keep his son in the palace, or depending on which story it is, make sure the prophecy about him becoming a great king comes to fruition. And as the authors say, it's as if he's trying to trap his son, ensnare him, and also hide from him things outside the wonders, the sensual delights of the palace. Now, when I was at Naropa, at Naropa University, where I went to graduate school, one of my classes with Judith Simmer Brown, I thought she sort of really put a lot of this into sort of, great perspective for us. She talked a little bit about, again, this kind of Indian context of the time, which you would kind of have to understand to really get a sense of the drama here. There's this issue of, and this might ring some bells for all of you, there's this issue of turning wheels being very important. This is a great metaphor in a lot of Indian culture. The Indian national flag, for example, has a wheel at the center of it. And in this Indian tradition of kingship, Judith was telling us, great kings turned the wheel and kept it turning. Their ancestors, their lineage would be responsible for keeping the system functioning that they're born into. And the wheel is sort of this symbol of cosmic, social and spiritual order kind of all at the same time. Judith used the analogy of Vedic priests keeping the wheel moving with the various rites and hymns and sacrifices and so forth that they were involved with. We talked about this kind of this issue that Stephen V. Beyer brought up about this simulacra. So, it was important because you were actually playing a role in the progress of the cosmos. And in their own way, these kings, kshatriyas, however you want to conceive of them, they were doing that in their own way by being good rulers and keeping the lineage of care in place this way. So when it's prophesized that Siddhartha Gautama will become either a great king or a great spiritual leader, if he becomes the latter, his father is essentially considered a failure. But it's not only personal, there's the sense of the wheel stops turning. And this sense of orderly progress being kind of lost. As Judith pointed out to us, the Buddha's concept of turning the wheel changes. And, we might think of this as one reason why he refers to it as, turning the wheel of the Dharma. That'll make some more sense later. But I really liked what Judith had said there, and I was thinking about it again. Reading this, so I wanted to make sure to say that. And Judith Simmer Brown, for those of you who are not aware, is a Shambhala Buddhist teacher and also a great scholar of Buddhist studies who has been at Naropa pretty much since the beginning and, big cheese in the religious studies department there. And she's also, just one of the greatest people you're ever going to meet. I had the fortune to TA for her a few times, and so I always enjoyed hearing her retell the story of the Buddha's life and kind of bring in this context and level of nuance to the story, which was always helpful, I thought. So the short of it is that we have the Buddha growing up in this sort of lavish, opulent lifestyle arranged by his father, who probably was concerned to a degree that his son would leave the palace and not continue this tradition of sort of cosmic progress that as part of a Kshatriya family he would be a part of. So in addition to all these things that the Buddha speaks about in the Pali Canon, he's married off to a woman named Yashodhara. And shortly after they're wed, there is a child whose name is Rahula, which can be translated as obstacle or fetter. And as the authors say, it's the naming of the child Rahula is suggestive that the Buddha is becoming more and more disenchanted and will probably soon leave the palace. So where does this disenchantment come from if the Buddha is surrounded by, this life of luxury? Well, I'm going to read directly how the authors put it. There are famously what are called the four sights, and here's how they describe them. And the preface to this is the Buddha one day ventures outside the palace, and in some retellings of the story, he effectively never leaves the palace, or never leaves the palace without sort of very careful handling, so that he doesn't sort of see anything that might inspire sort of existential reflection, or anything that might put him on the path of becoming a spiritual teacher, a wandering mendicant, this sort of thing. It's a little bit like, I suppose, if you're looking, if you need an analogy for this, it was a bit like the film The Truman Show. It's this movie with Jim Carrey that Peter Weir directed about reality television show where a man is kept in a town that's designed specifically to sort of be idyllic and keep him entertained. But of course, the irony of the film and the comment of the film is that that only works so long before someone starts to wonder what's outside the bubble. Similarly here, I think some retellings include an element of curiosity in the Buddha's life story, but, for all intents and purposes, we could imagine that he's, not at all troubled with the world because he doesn't see any sort of suffering or anything that causes him to question the wonderfulness of his life. So this is why the story of the four sights is important here. So he goes for a chariot ride through the capital city in Kapilavastu and sort of has a dialogue with his attendant, Channa. And here's how the authors describe what happens on the chariot ride. There, for the first time, the Buddha saw a decrepit old man. Shocked, he asked his charioteer about the man's condition. The charioteer replied that this was the destiny of all human beings. The prince turned back to the palace and brooded, taking no relish in the gaiety around him. On the second ride, he saw the first diseased man and reflected that people are foolish to revel under the constant shadow of illness. On the third trip, he saw his first corpse. Dismayed, he marveled that people could live heedlessly, forgetting the certainty of death. So what happens next before we get the fourth sight is really important and key to most biographies of the Buddha, whether we're talking about the manga series or Bertolucci's film or these very early biographies like the Bodhicharita or the Mahavastu. And again, the authors just beautifully put this in a couple of sentences, so I'm gonna read this in full. In an artfully composed dialogue, the king's counselor advises the young prince to disregard his disturbing encounters and to follow the example of ancient heroes and sages in pursuing the pleasures of erotic love. The bodhisattva's reply is an eloquent statement of the ascetic case against the sensual life. Sensual joys are fleeting. Death always casts its long shadow over life, blighting all transient pleasures. The only true happiness would be one not subject to change. The pursuit of any lesser pleasure cannot be held up as a fulfilling or noble ideal. And so then, you know, following this discussion, which, again, by the way, is, as I sort of pointed out, is very beautifully done in a lot of biographies, including the Bertolucci film. I think it's a really well-done scene. So the Buddha goes, after this dialogue, goes out again, and he sees this time peasants plowing a field. And as the authors say, he's moved to grief at sort of all the suffering contained in, you know, in what's it's essentially a sort of, you know, daily mundane task. There's the suffering of the workers and the oxen, and then of course, you know, insects, worms, things that live in the ground are being harmed, even killed in this process. And he retires to a nearby grove and sort of sits alone in meditation. And one of the stories that I've seen, part of the Buddha's life that I've seen sort of rearranged depending on the biography is, as a child, he has an experience of sort of a jhanic state in meditation, and he sort of looks back on that as a touchstone and, you know, is one of the reasons he sits. Other stories, I think Thich Nhat Hanh's Old Path, White Clouds, if I remember correctly, makes this moment, he sort of collides two moments, that one when he's a child and this experience into one. But his sort of experience under what's called a rose apple tree, it kind of moves around, at least in some of the biographies I've seen. But as the authors retell it in Buddhist religions, two separate events, and so we're only hearing about one right now, but there'll be more about the experience as a child in just a moment. So he's sitting alone in meditation, and a shramana, a sort of wandering ascetic, happens to the scene. And the Buddha, of course, is not familiar with wandering mendicants any more than he's familiar with death, old age, and sickness. So he wonders what the man is doing, and the reply is, "I dwell wherever I happen to be, at the root of a tree or in a deserted temple, on hill or in forest, wandering without expectations or ties, in search of the highest good." And this is another beautiful section by the authors, in which they sort of point out the significance of this. And what it inspires, because what it ends up inspiring is the Buddha leaving home to sort of pursue this sort of life. And as they point out, you know, Ashvaghosha paints this beautifully with the Buddha watching his wife and newborn son sleep and sort of slipping away out of the palace. I alluded to the Buddhist Geeks conversation earlier, and I say a bit in that interview about what Thich Nhat Hanh does differently in terms of the relationship between Yashodhara and the Buddha, which I think is really exciting and a neat part of that book. So again, depending on whose biography you're reading, there might be differences in how he leaves the palace and who's aware and who's not aware. You know, and so this is a somewhat shocking moment. You know, he's leaving behind this responsibility to be a wheel-turning king, at least ostensibly, it seems that way. And, you know, he's leaving a wife and child, which, you know, in itself is a little bit startling, especially to modern readers. There's been some beautiful poetry in my friend Gary Gock's book, What Book? Buddha Poems from Beat to Hip Hop. There's a beautiful poem sort of contemplating, I would say, Yashodhara's perspective. And it's well worth a read. And I'll get the name and author for the next podcast for you. So there's this leaving home, which entails, you know, personal, social, religious, cosmic pieces. You know, there are sort of consequences on all these levels, but also possibilities. So you might say there's possibilities and problematics in what's happening. And I think the authors really state this well, and here's what they write. In this, the Buddha leaving home, it foreshadows a theme that has played out in Buddhist religions up to the present, the tension between the merits of civilization and those of the wilderness. Although the wilderness is definitely favored as the place for testing oneself and discovering the truth, the duties of civilized life are not entirely denied. At each crucial juncture prior to his flight, Siddhartha recognizes his familial duty and expresses strong affection toward his father. If he transcends birth and death, he promises to return to teach his discovery to his family. This parallels the position that Buddhist thought and life have assumed over the centuries, straddling the line between civilization and the wilderness. The verse portions of the Pali Canon, for example, contain some of the world's first wilderness poetry, alongside verses detailing the duties and joys of a happily married life. The tradition's ability to bridge the gap between the city and the wilds in this way has proven to be a source of enduring strength. So, you know, again, we're only seeing sort of the beginning of a contemplation here in the story, and then the beginning of, you know, sort of a rich tradition of thought, writing, work, relationship, etc., through history and the Buddhist religions. And the authors also point out that we have this issue of two emotions being important in the story, and I think this is a really rich thing to talk about. Mark Epstein, who's also in David Gruben's film about the Buddha, has done some really, I think, striking writing about, you know, kind of the emotional life of the Buddha and, you know, sort of emotions on the path for practitioners. So I like that the authors sort of take a moment here and consider part of the emotional life of the Buddha, and especially aspects that have significance for us. The first is what's called samvega, and the authors defined samvega as the emotion the prince felt on his first encounter with aging, illness, and death. Samvega covers a broad range of feeling, ranging from the simple act of coming to one's senses after a bout of foolish carelessness, to a more extreme sense of alienation, awe, shock, and dismay over the futility of life as it is normally lived, combined with a strong sense of urgency in trying to find escape from the trap of futility. I promise I won't be that guy who's always linking to things that he's written or so forth. But I recently wrote an article about for Inquiring Mind about how I got into practice. They had asked me to sort of write about how I became a Buddhist. And it was really the fear of death. And I think it has a lot to do, you know, with this feeling of samvega. So I'll link to that as well. And I think there's, you know, we could maybe find interesting parallels in Western thought here. I think I hear a lot of Kierkegaard's fear and trembling in this, although there's a lot more to Kierkegaard's fear and trembling than just that. But, you know, so I think this is a very common feeling, but, you know, typical of Indian languages. It's really kind of beautifully captured in a rich word. And the companion emotion is prasada, which the authors define as the emotion the prince felt on encountering the four Shramana, a clear sense of serene confidence that one has found the way out. As the word prasada is also used to describe the clarity of a calm lake, the implicit image is that samvega stirs up the mind, whereas prasada makes it calm. The two emotions provide proper balance for each other. Samvega keeps prasada grounded in reality. Prasada keeps samvega from turning into hopelessness. And I was reminded, sort of revisiting the term prasada and thinking about it, of the Tricycle magazine had a conference at the World Trade Center in 2001, in July of 2001, so it was just shortly before the destruction of the towers on September 11th. It was a gathering of a lot of different Buddhist teachers and thinkers for sort of a conference workshop kind of atmosphere. And one of the centerpieces of it was a dialogue between my pal Sharon Salzberg and Stephen Batchelor. And both of them at the time were working on books that I think became very popular. Sharon's book, Faith, and then Stephen Batchelor's book on doubt. And so they had a debate about the sort of virtues faith and doubt. And in a lot of what I remember Sharon saying, and in some of the things I remember from the book, you know, I think the way she defines faith, you know, there's a lot from Prasada that's implicit in that, that you know, this line about Samvega keeps Prasada grounded in reality, Prasada keeps Samvega from turning into hopelessness. And I remember the way Sharon was advocating for faith on the path, I think was important in this respect. And the way she allowed for doubt, I think, again, she really framed doubt in the same way here. I don't think doubt is a very good analogy for Samvega, but I think they're qualities of what from Samvega and perhaps what Batchelor was talking about with doubt. Maybe it was a you had to be there kind of thing. But I think the way I remember Sharon talking about faith, I think calls to mind a lot of this material. So the Buddha is a new wandering mendicant. He's 29 years old. And he first finds a teacher. And the teacher's name is Arada Kalama. And as the authors say, he taught a form of meditation leading to, quote, the dimension of nothingness. And so Siddhartha practices this, quickly achieves this dimension of nothingness. And Kalama would like the Buddha to be his co-teacher and considers him an equal in terms of realization. But the Buddha felt that what he was learning was not conducive to nirvana. And the authors say this is a term that literally means the extinguishing of fire, but figuratively the highest happiness of freedom and peace. And this is an interesting issue I'd like to talk about some more later. These sort of images captured in words like dukkha, nirvana, that often we have a very literal earthy image attached to them. And so, you know, trying to capture them in a word like suffering or extinguishment, there's a kind of an incompleteness there. And one of the issues of, you know, the problem of doing things in translation, that there's a richer meaning when you kind of get as literal as possible with them. So this is just a hint to a future discussion here. So he leaves Kalama and finds another teacher named Udraka Ramaputra. And Udraka teaches this dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. And once again, Siddhartha grasps this quickly, and Udraka would like to take the Buddha as Siddhartha as his teacher. But again, the same issue, he's dissatisfied and feels that this does not equal the highest happiness. It's something else. So the Buddha, Siddhartha, heads eastward towards Uruvela near Bodh Gaya, and he finds a sort of forested area and begins the practice of austerities. And these include suppressing the breath, fasting. There are many statues people have probably seen of the Buddha during this period of his life where he's extremely thin. And the Pali Canon gives some rich descriptions of this in Ashvaghosha as well, you know, that the Buddha's spine was visible from his front. He became so thin and he looked very skeletal. And often in these statues that you see, it really almost looks like a skeleton with the other features of the Buddha. And so in this practice, he's joined by five other ascetics and, you know, who are all practicing different austerities, sometimes the same ones, sometimes distinct ones. And, you know, he does this for a long while, but then eventually there's another realization. And again, the authors put it beautifully. They write, he remembered an incident in his childhood, and this was the one I alluded to earlier. While sitting under a shady tree as his father was performing a royal plowing ritual, he had entered the first jhana, a rapturous state of concentration. Perhaps, he surmised, this might be the path. Although he had seen that mental absorption did not constitute liberation, it might act as a part of the path to that goal. His body, however, was too weak to regain that blissful concentration. And so then, in Ashvaghosha's telling, the Buddha, after kind of having this realization, sits under a sacred tree where a woman named Sujata, who had vowed to offer to make offerings to the deity of the tree in exchange for granting her a son. Sujata encounters Siddhartha and believes him to be the spirit, so offers him a bowl of fine rice milk. And the Buddha takes it, and this is considered to be a sort of poetical gesture about an important aspect of the Buddha's teaching, which is the middle way, that to reach awakening, it requires this path between extreme austerity and sensual indulgence. So we've had the Buddha have this experience of sensual indulgence living in the palace growing up, and we've had this experience of extreme austerity in his time in the forest and with his teachers. So he's, again, expressing the middle way here in taking care of himself. He's not able to reach this jhanic concentration because of his physical condition, but that doesn't mean he needs to pig out and eat everything. So you know, just that he's taking care of himself, he's actually having a meal so that he can practice well. This is significant in terms of conveying through literature what the middle way is. The five mendicants, however, feel that he's turned his back on them and the path that they're on, and sort of effectively make it clear to him that he's no longer welcome to practice with them. So the Buddha now is still in Bodhgaya, no longer in the company of the five ascetics, and he finds a Bodhi tree. A Bodhi means awakening. Faces east and resolves not to move from seated meditation under the tree until he attains this goal that he's looking for, this thing called nirvana. Now, in retellings of the story, there's another sort of, well, as the authors say, it sort of blurs the line between poetry and psychology, so I don't want to say, you know, that it's not literal, but Mara, who is the personification of death and temptation, sort of a deity figure, grows alarmed. I think there's a strong sense in the air, obviously, from the prediction of Asita when Siddhartha is a baby, up to the reaction of the forest when the Buddha comes to sit under this tree. The authors say, the birds and beasts of the forest fell quiet in anticipation. There's a sense that he is going to achieve this goal. And it's a threat to Mara because it means that someone is about to escape from his realm, in a sense, this realm of temptation and death. And, you know, one of the things that the Buddha is working to overcome is this thing that in the Pali language is called tanha, or thirst, a kind of desire. And this is Mara's bread and butter. And, you know, obviously the Buddha is concerned about old age, sickness, and death, and trying to figure out how does one live and attain the highest happiness in the shadow of these things. So, you know, the Siddhartha here is a quite a threat to Mara, who doesn't really want people overcoming temptation and the sufferings of old age, sickness, and death. So there's an attempt to divert him, and again, as I pointed out, the authors say this freely blurs the lines between psychology and allegory. So Mara first sends his 10 armies, which are effectively, in Ashvaghosha's retelling and in the Pali, representative of certain qualities that the Buddha has to overcome or demonstrate that he's overcome to really assert awakening here. And so the 10 armies represent sensuality, discontent, hunger and thirst, craving, sloth and lethargy, fear, doubt, hypocrisy, self-exaltation, and the desire for fame. And, you know, it's interesting, depending on whose biography you're reading, sometimes, as the authors point out also, Ashvaghosha kind of goes into gory details and describes, you know, the armies, you know, sort of being, you know, demon-like and having these monster qualities. And, you know, at the risk of sounding critical, I mean, I think one of the things that's important in this is not only him sort of overcoming armies, but the qualities that they represent. And so that's I think really important that the authors sort of point out what these 10 armies represent, because we're looking at this psychologically or allegorically, that's really important. So the army doesn't work, and Mara this time sends his daughters, who are discontent, delight, and craving, to seduce Siddhartha. You know, I really like the sort of poetry in this, you know, that one is really seduced by these particular qualities, whereas there's a kind of aggression in the 10 qualities that we mentioned before. There's a really seductive quality to discontent, delight, and craving. But discontent, delight, and craving fail to seduce the Buddha. And so then, as the authors write, and again, very beautifully, legends postdating Ashvaghosha, however, add that Mara finally challenged the Bodhisattva's right to awakening, in response to which the Bodhisattva touched Mother Earth to bear witness to his merit. She rose up and squeezed an ocean of water out of her hair, symbolic of the cooling waters of his many past good deeds, washing the armies away. The heavens then cleared, in Ashvaghosha's words, shining with the moon like a maiden with a smile, and a shower of sweet-smelling flowers rained down. The Bodhisattva returned to his quest. And of this moment, this touching of the earth, is very well represented in a lot of Buddhist art and architecture, iconography. I think most Buddhist statues that you're, you know, sort of going to see popularly have one of a couple of gestures, and one of them is the earth-touching mudra, where the Buddha's palm is facing inward and his fingers are sort of touching the ground where his feet are. And, yeah, as they say, there's a certain sense of the Buddha asserting his victory over these elements by saying, my countenance, the way I walk upon the earth, the effect of my being on the earth is proof enough. So, as to the awakening itself, the authors here point to a quote from the Pali Canon, from one of the suttas, in which it's made clear that the knowledge of awakening has sort of two components. And this is the quote itself. First, there is the knowledge of the regularity of phenomena, the laws underlying all action. Then there is the knowledge of nirvana. And they also go on to say that another sutta sort of gives even more detail about this, and describes the first component here this way. That Siddhartha first divides his thoughts into two sorts, and the authors describe them this way. First, there are those leading to affliction for himself or others. These he determined were thoughts imbued with sensual passion, ill will, or harmfulness. And thoughts free from sensual passion, ill will, or harmfulness, which led to no affliction for anyone. With regards to thoughts of the first sort, the goal was to obliterate them. With regards to thoughts of the second sort, he sort of allowed them free rein. Sort of, he's operating under an ethic here that, again, there are these unwholesome, harmful states, and the best policy there is to obliterate them because there's no benefit to oneself or others. And with regards to the second, they can be allowed, the second set of thoughts, they can be allowed free rein because they may have beneficial qualities here. But then they go on to say this, the authors. But even non-afflictive thinking, he concluded, tires the mind. And so he steadied his mind in concentration. One tradition states that he focused on his in and out breathing and ascended the four stages of dhyana. And the four stages of dhyana are described thus. The first dhyana is, they say, quote, meditative absorption produced by detaching from sensual thoughts and unskillful attitudes. And they go on to sort of describe it as the mind attaining unity while evaluating the object to which it consciously directs its attention, giving rise to a sense of rapture and ease born of seclusion. The second dhyana is free from evaluation and directed thought. So there's kind of a non-judgmental quality here, and they say that there's a singleness of mind and internal assurance with rapture and ease born of composure. And the third jhana, they qualify as equanimous rather than rapturous, and it's a quality of alertness and mindfulness with, quote, a feeling of bodily ease. And then the fourth jhana is pure equanimity, mindfulness free of pleasure and pain. And then the authors state that this fourth jhana serves as the foundation for the six abhijñas, or super-knowledges. And those are, I'm just going to list them here, psychic powers, the divine ear or psychic hearing, knowledge of others' minds, memory of one's former lives, the divine eye or clairvoyance, and the ending of ashrava or binding effluence or pollutants of the mind. And these, as they say, are namely sensual desire, becoming, views, and ignorance. Now, the first five of the abhijñas, as they say, could be characterized as mundane, as they have this quality of not releasing the mind from the ashravas. And only the sixth, which could be described as supramundane, has this quality. And as they say, it, quote, opens the mind to the deathlessness of nirvana. Now, the authors also want to say something interesting here. Both the suttas and Ashvaghosha describe Gautama's progress toward the deathless in terms of the three cognitions identical with three of the super-knowledges. So there's this first, what's referred to as the first watch of the night, which is dusk to 10 p.m., in which the Buddha, Siddhartha, acquires the first cognition, which the authors describe as identical with the fourth superknowledge, that of recollecting his previous lives over many eons. And then, as the authors say, he's struck by the meaninglessness of the chain of lifetimes. And during the second watch of the night, which is 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., he turns his mind to the second cognition and fifth superknowledge, which is the knowledge of the death and rebirth of living beings everywhere. And the authors write, "The entire cosmos," Ashvaghosha says, "appeared to him as in a spotless mirror. He saw that good karma, under the influence of right views, leads to a happy rebirth on the upper realms of existence, whereas evil karma, under the influence of wrong views, leads to a miserable one in the realms of deprivation." And so he's dismayed by, as they say, the suffering inherent in this endless cycling through death and rebirth, and then goes into the third watch, which is 2 a.m. to dawn. And again, his mind turns to, this time, a third cognition, sixth superknowledge, and it's, as they say, that of the ending of the ashravas. And this involves realizing praticca sumutpada, which I'm going to hold off on saying anything more about, but it's also known as dependent co-arising. We're going to talk a lot more about this later, so I won't go into it at this juncture. But that's a component here, at least according to Ashvaghosha's retelling of the Buddha's life. And then they quote the Pali directly here. The authors give a long quote from the Pali, and I think it's worth reading. And as they say, it's very terse. That's the word they use, and direct on this. So here's what the Pali says about what's going on here. "When the mind was thus concentrated," and this is the Buddha speaking, "I directed it to the knowledge of the ending of the ashravas. I discerned, as it actually was, that this is dukkha. This is the origination of dukkha. This is the cessation of dukkha. This is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. These are the ashravas. This is the origination of the ashravas. This is the cessation of the ashravas. This is the way leading to the cessation of the ashravas. My heart, thus knowing, thus seeing, was released from the ashrava of sensual desire, released from the ashrava of becoming, released from the ashrava of views, and released from the ashrava of ignorance. With release, there was the knowledge, released. I discerned that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is nothing further for this world. This was the third knowledge I attained in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed, light arose, as happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute. And then, as the authors say, with this knowledge that came during the third watch, we kind of see, basically we kind of hearken back to the beginning of this section where I talked about the Pali Sutta saying that there's knowledge of the regularity of phenomena and knowledge of nirvana. So by the end of this evening, by the dawn, the Buddha has both of these pieces. And here's how the authors close this section. They write, "With this knowledge, as the new day dawned, Gautama completed the first step of awakening, the knowledge of the regularity of phenomena, and arrived at the second step of awakening, the unconditioned bliss of nirvana. According to Ashvaghosha, the natural world celebrated the event with miracles. The earth swayed, thunder rolled, rain fell from the cloudless sky, and blossoms fell from the heavens. The beings of the world, for the moment, were at peace, with none giving way to anger, passion, or intoxication. The beings of the heavens showed reverence to Gautama, now the Buddha, and sang his praise." So I spoke at the beginning of the podcast about wanting to do shorter podcasts in the future, and what did I do today? I managed to lap myself, and this is the longest one yet at nearly an hour and 10 minutes. I will try in the future to do smaller bites. I would like to, if possible, complete this book sometime in the next 20 years. So I'll have to kind of balance that with wanting to move through this book efficiently. But I will try to do shorter in the future. But we've ended at a good point, I think, today. Siddhartha Gautama becoming the Buddha. As you can tell, I was in a big hurry to start calling him the Buddha. I forgot many points to refer to him as Siddhartha or Gautama, and instead referred to him as the Buddha. But I guess I can do that from now on in the book, since we're to the point of calling him the Buddha. Next week, we'll do either the all of section 1.4, or we'll do part of it, which has to do with the lessons of awakening. So thank you if you've made it this far. If you have questions, you can leave them at the anywhere, however you're getting to this podcast, whether it's through the blog or social networking where I'm posting new podcasts and blogs and such, or, you know, however you can get a hold of me. And thank you to Chuck Priebisch and our commenter who asked about shorter podcasts, and everyone who's given me feedback and sending questions and so forth. I hope this is helpful, and I look forward to doing this more in the future. So may you be happy, may you be well, may you be peaceful.